God, please help me set aside everything I think I know about myself, my disease, these thefts, and especially you, for an open mind and a new experience with myself, my disease, these thefts, and especially you. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce Tim.
Good evening, everyone. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name's Tim.
Hi, Tim.
Thank you for all you people who have been consistently coming. I appreciate that. And to the people who are new, welcome. My usual disclaimer is that this is my experience, strength, and hope with the book Alcoholics Anonymous, known as the Big Book. It's my opinion. I don't speak for Alcoholics Anonymous, although at times I will sound that way. So I apologize in advance for that. This is generally the experience of what anybody would have if they sat down one-on-one with me across the table, so I try to pass that along on a group level here. Where do I want to start? We're starting on page 30, chapter 3, more about alcoholism this week. Last week we discussed there is a solution, and I skipped over the appendix, the spiritual experience. And at this time, before we get into chapter 3, I'd like to go and read that. It's in the back of the book. It's appendix 2. It's 569 in the third edition, and I think it's 571 in the fourth. I could be wrong. Appendix 2, spiritual experience. The terms spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which, upon careful reading, shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming, quote-unquote, God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experience are what the psychologist William James calls the quote-unquote educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped it, an unsuspecting inner resource which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than themselves is the essence of spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it, quote-unquote, God consciousness. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. And the quote here says, "There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation." And it's attributed to Herbert Spencer. My sources and many other people who have discussed it say that Herbert Spencer didn't say that. So I don't know, maybe they just threw it on there because he was a smart guy or something. One of the things that I like to point out here, where it says that last paragraph, we find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. It's funny to say the spirituality part, of the spiritual part of the program. It's kind of like saying the wet part of the ocean. You know, it's a spiritual program. And that's what I came here for. It's what was presented to me. And I was one of those people that was against the God thing, because of my upbringing, my background, that God didn't work for me. And, you know, and when I turned to God, God disappointed me, those types of things. Those thoughts went with me constantly. And I was very thrilled at the time to be handed this book, because when I read this book, I was studying Eastern philosophies at the time. So I had a different view on what the book was telling me. Although a lot of the early members come from a Judeo-Christian background, for me, the Buddhist and the Zen and the Taoist philosophies were in here. So I was excited about that because I was like, oh, okay, cool. They don't just mean one particular religion or one particular spirituality. They mean all of them. So that was very refreshing for me because I was able to come to terms with a belief in a higher power that worked for me, because the higher power that I was presented with my entire life didn't. I didn't trust that one. I didn't believe that that was the one for me. And if the answer to my problems, the solution was God, and it was that God, I was doomed. You know, so I was very fortunate. You know, I've talked about in my story that I had one of those sudden spiritual experiences that, as it's described nowadays, that white light experience, you know, the last time I was hungover. And the words, "I'm going to die," came out of my mouth. And I remember arguing with it out loud. "What do you mean I'm going to die? I don't care. When am I going to die?" "No, you're going to die." Because at the time, I knew that those words, "I'm going to die," meant that I had to quit drinking. And at the time, I was only 21. I wasn't even 22 yet, so I was drinking legally for less than a year. And I was like, "What do you mean I got to quit drinking? You might as well kill me." That's how I felt. But yet there was this strange notion that, as it talks about in that spiritual experience, that that inner untapped resource that I was connecting to at that moment. You know, some people say it's your conscience, some people say it's the connection to the universe. And, you know, whatever your argument may be, it's certainly there and alive in me. And I'm very grateful for that kind of thing, because that has become my guidance throughout the years. I don't always follow it because I'm not perfect, you know, but it definitely becomes that thing that when I get off the spiritual beam kind of smacks me in the head and says, "Hey, where are you going? Get back on there." And, you know, I had a lot more latitude years ago. I could do a lot more dumb things, and it was, I didn't have as much pain, but I don't have a high tolerance to pain anymore. So I get off the beam and I'm pain. Oh, I got to get back on the beam. And that's been my experience of it. So with that said, moving on to chapter 3, more about alcoholism, page 30. And it says, "Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people." That's a mouthful right there. You know, to be honest with you, I didn't have a problem admitting that I was a drunk. I had no problem admitting that. And I welcomed it. I relished it. You know, I wore it like a badge of honor. "Oh, yes, I'm a drunk." And but then when I got here and I had to become an alcoholic, well, you know, I'm a drunk, you know. And so I was definitely unwilling. You know, and as we talked about last week, that willingness, and it talks about it in that spiritual experience, that willingness is eager compliance, a cheerful choice. So I definitely was not cheerful about admitting that I was an alcoholic. And I certainly wasn't eagerly compliant to do it either. You know, so it certainly described me. I was unwilling. And I didn't think I was bodily or mentally different than my fellows. I just thought I couldn't drink the right way, or I drank too much. And like most people, they come here and AA is going to teach them how to drink like a gentleman or a lady. And that's kind of what I thought. I was like, well, maybe I just don't know some secret, and those people do, and I'll go check them out. And, you know, and it's funny, I never really had vain attempts to prove I could drink like other people. I knew I couldn't drink like other people. I knew they couldn't drink like me, you know, and I was like, you need to step up and get in the game here, because this is how a pro does it. You know, that was how I felt about it. So, the idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every normal drinker. Abnormal drinker, excuse me, that's important, sorry. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. And those are some pretty foreboding warnings there. I mean, for me, I certainly understood the great obsession, because I have an obsessive mind. I obsess, and it compels me to do things. And I don't know how anybody else, what their experience is. I know my experience is, if I was controlling my drinking, I wasn't enjoying it. And if I was enjoying my drinking, I wasn't controlling it. There was no middle of the road. There wasn't, oh, tonight's the night I'm going to control it. And then I sit there aggravated because I'm watching everybody and I have to nurse this beer and been looking at it for 20 minutes already. You know, like, when can I get to my second one? You know, and like, that was my obsessive mind. So I couldn't hear conversations, and I couldn't see people, because all I was concerned with was getting that drink in me so I could get to the next one. So that was, you know, and that was the, I love how he says, the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. And I was certainly pursuing it into the gaze of insanity or death. I welcomed death at that point in my life. I didn't care. Like, I looked at it like, live hard, die young, leave a beautiful corpse. And that was my thing. So to that end, that's how I would live my life. And I was certainly insane. Only insane people get on the hoods of cars and hold on and start, have the driver drive around the parking lot and start going, come on, knock me off. You know, that's insane. It's not, you know, like, what was I doing? So, but you certainly couldn't tell me that it was my drinking that was causing that. That's just my personality. You know, that's just who I am. So now here comes the big whammy here. It says, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. And then it gives us a clue. This is the first step in recovery. Thanks. I mean, like, you know, where I was at, I certainly needed to be hit in the head with something like that. It was like Captain Obvious there. That was my... That's the first step of recovery. I have to fully concede to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. Now, it's important there. The key word in there is learned. Now, from my experience, there's only two ways of learning. Either you teach yourself or somebody else teaches you. I haven't found a third one. You know, maybe if they come up with chips that we can just put in a slot in our head, I may be up for that. But I've watched other people, and that's how I've learned, or I've taught myself, and that's how I've learned, or somebody's taught me, and that's how I've learned. And so through trial and error, through, as they call it, countless vain attempts to prove I can drink like other people, I had to get to the point where I had to fully concede, and that's very redundant there, fully concede. And what does concede mean? You know, I've heard for many years, surrender, you got to surrender, you got to surrender. And there's a difference between surrendering and conceding. When I surrender, like, here's a perfect example. Anybody who's ever been, like, messing around or slap fighting or wrestling with somebody, you know, and they're starting to get the best of you, and you go, okay, I give. Then they let you go and you hit them. You know, that's surrendering. But yet you're right back in the fight almost immediately. So conceding, like, I've learned that conceding is to surrender for the last time, never to fight again. Like retiring, you know, unlike Sugar Ray Leonard or Ali, you know, like once I retired and I'm not fighting anymore. So I learned that that's what I had to do. I had to fully concede to my innermost self. Now I can tell all of you that I'm an alcoholic. That's easy. Oh, okay, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. But meanwhile, in the back of my mind somewhere, inside, there may be something that's challenging that notion, that thought. And I had to get to that point of giving up. All right, you got me. Now what? Right? So then it continues. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently maybe, has to be smashed. Now, delusion, for me, like, delusion is a great word. And the best way that I can describe delusion is looking at a funhouse mirror. You know, when you go to the funhouse and you go and you look in the mirror and it makes you tall and skinny, or it makes you short and fat. And like, to me, that's what a delusion is. Like, it's not the full view of who I am. So I could say, well, you know, I'm not as bad as him, or I'm not as bad as her, and look at that, you know. So that's my delusion talking. And that has to be smashed. And the only way that I have found that that worked was other people telling me about their delusions and their stories and their experiences of what they had done. And realizing that, wow, I'm just like these people. And they're alcoholics. Oh, man, you know what that means? You know, like, that's where it got to for me. So it was smashed. Right? So now he goes on to describe alcoholics. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. Point blank, says it. Control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And, you know, I've talked about this before. I identify myself as a recovered alcoholic because I've done the work necessary to bring about an entire psyche change that spelled the vital spiritual experience that provided that removed my desire for drinking. And for me, it's important for me to point this out, but because I'm recovered, I understand and realize that I can no longer safely put alcohol in my body, regardless. Regardless. It doesn't matter if I'm recovered. I could be recovered for 40 years. If I put alcohol in my body, here we go. Okay, so that's important for me to put out there. And I love this where he says, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And all I have to think about are days waking up on bus stop benches with the sun blaring on me. Or waking up and going, who are you? Or waking up and going, where's my wallet? Or waking up and going, why does my face hurt? Or waking up and saying, why is there blood on my clothes? Or waking up going, where am I? Where's my car? Oh, that's right, I took the train. You know, all these things. I mean, it's just pitiful. It's pitiful. And me, being the bright and intelligent guy I am, like, it's incomprehensible that I could do that. Don't you know who I am? And that, you know, like, oh, no, it's not the drinking. I didn't pay attention. You know, it's all those excuses that come with it, you know. And somebody says, we are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. Now, of course, he's talking about of our type. We talked about that earlier on, the real alcoholic of the hopeless variety. The one that Silkworth describes as not being able to take any alcohol and the manifestation of the allergy and the phenomenon of craving. That's our type. That's what I identified with. It's our type because I was in the grip of a progressive illness. And over time, it wasn't getting better. It definitely was not getting better. It was definitely getting worse. And my experience of watching other people who are real alcoholics of the hopeless variety go through those stages of that obsessive thinking and then the physical compulsion and then picking up the drink and setting off that cycle, that phenomenon of craving and that allergic reaction, it just watching that, it's been proven to me that over a considerable period of time, people get worse, never better. Because unfortunately, I've seen people with 20 plus, 30 plus years relapse. And I've watched what happened to them in a short amount of time. Like, how could that be? 30 years away? Wow. So it certainly proved it. And he just pounds it home. He says, we are like men who have lost their legs. They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. We have tried every imaginable remedy. In some instances, there have been brief recovery, followed always by still worse relapse. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree there is no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. Science may one day accomplish it, but it hasn't done so yet. And it's not for trying, because they try all the time. Constantly, oh, you take this pill and you'll be able to drink normally. Oh, you take this pill and you won't drink as much. Oh, you take this pill to make you sick. Now, it says, any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. Now I want to address that, because that's important. I have known people in Alcoholics Anonymous who have had cirrhotic livers and who have gotten liver replacements, liver transplants. So you would think, hey, all right, all bets are off. I got a new liver. This one's not broken. Right? And they go back to drinking. And in time, they're still just as bad as they were and worse than when they stopped drinking. So it proves, to me anyway, that chemical reaction that we have in our brain, of that THIQ that we have, is sitting there dormant, regardless as to what's going on with our body, because that's a medical treatment. Wow, a new liver, thank you, I can drink again. But, you know, like, here we're talking about, like, there's been proof that, like, no, you need a new brain, dude, if you're going to drink again, you know, and it just becomes like, wow, it really is in my head,
right.
You know, physically, and that's just, it's amazing, I love that, because further on the book it says more will be revealed, and I love how God reveals that stuff, love it, absolutely love it. Okay, so then he says, despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe they are in that class. You ever meet anybody like that? By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exceptions to the rule, therefore not alcoholic. Now, I love this one, because this is, here's a first thing that AA is not a temperance society. We're not out to, like, stop everyone from drinking. right? And it says it right here. If anyone who is showing the inability to control his drinking can do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. Okay, well, I personally know people who came in the program or came into the fellowship when they were young, in their teens, you know, because mom or dad caught them drinking at a party or something like that, and that, you know, they went off to the well-intentioned treatment facilities for 2 years, you know, and now I'm an alcoholic, and, you know, and in the back of their head, they're like, how is that possible? How is that possible, right? And I personally know at least three people that were in Alcoholics Anonymous, had at least 5 years of recovery, bless you, and had returned to drinking successfully. Okay, because they were not a real alcoholic of our type. They put the alcohol in, and it didn't have the same kind of reaction. They weren't craving that next one. They weren't obsessing about that next drink. They can control and enjoy their drinking. That's been my experience. I'm not making stories up like that. That's real. And my hats are off to them. Because I'm of the opinion that if you're not a real alcoholic of the hopeless variety, please don't come to Alcoholics Anonymous and try to change it. Because it's gone on for years. People come in, and this directly talks about it. And they try to make AA something it isn't. You know, and we're going to get into that over the next 2 pages. And he says, here are some of the methods we have tried. And there's my colon. You remember my colon, right? And so here it is. He says, drinking beer only, limiting the number of drinks, never drinking alone, never drinking in the morning, drinking only at home, never having it in the house, never drinking during business hours, drinking only at parties, switching from scotch to brandy, drinking only natural wines, agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job, taking a trip, not taking a trip, swearing off with and without the soul at most, taking more physical exercise, reading inspirational books, going to health farms and sanitariums, accepting volunteer commitments to asylums. We could increase the list ad infinitum. What's that? So it just becomes this insidious nature of alcoholism. Now, here we go. We do not like to pronounce any individual as alcoholic, but you can quickly diagnose yourself. Now, it doesn't say we're not going to. It says we don't like to. Some of us do. Some of us do. I don't mind. I'll tell you you're an alcoholic. You know, I have... Actually, you know, I have educational training that allows me to tell if somebody's an alcoholic beyond my personal experience. So I don't mind telling them, but AA themselves, they don't like to pronounce anyone. And let me tell you, here they're going to give you some directions, which I love. Here's the second time, in one page, step over to the nearest bar room and try some controlled drinking. Try to drink and stop abruptly. Try it more than once. It will not take long for you to decide. If you are honest with yourself about it, it may be worth a bad case of the jitters to get a full knowledge of your condition. So, they're in three times, Alcoholics Anonymous is telling people, go be done. Go be done. If you're done, come on in, we have a solution. And it works wonderfully. But if you're not done and you're hemming and hawing, please go get a full knowledge of your condition. And it may be worth a bad case of the jitters to do that in order to get you to where we are. So, you know, how could you tell somebody to go and drink? I said, it's on page 31. It's not me. So they wrote it, right? Okay, so, he goes on. There is no way of proving it. We believe that early in our drinking careers, most of us could have stopped drinking. But the difficulty is that few alcoholics have enough desire to stop while there is yet time. We've heard a few instances where people who showed definite signs of alcoholism were able to stop for a long period because of an overpowering desire to do so. Here's one. Now, he's going to tell a story about this. Now, it's interesting. My friend Chris is usually here. He often talks about crossing that imaginary line. And this is what Bill's talking about here. I know... I'm not sure that I was set out to become an alcoholic when I started drinking. But I remember at some point in my drinking, it was all on. All right, we're going. We're going for it. We're there, you know. And so that was something that I was after. And there was no desire to stop. Okay, and it talks about that. There was no desire. I was young. I mean, I remember when that kind of clicked, that notion, I was like 19. And I was like, okay, the destruction is on. Right, that notion clicked in. And that's what I followed. So there wasn't a desire then. I certainly had time because I didn't break myself yet. I didn't break my liver. I didn't break my brain. I still had the ability to leave it alone if I needed to, if there was an overpowering desire. But but it never was. You know? Okay, so he says, a man of 30 was doing a great deal of free drinking. He was very nervous in the morning after these bouts and quieted himself with more liquor. He was ambitious to succeed in business, but saw that he would get nowhere if he drank at all. Once he started, he had no control whatever. That certainly describes me. Once I started, I had no control whatever. He made up his mind that until he had been successful in business and had retired, he would not touch another drop. An exceptional man, he remained bone dry for 25 years and retired at the age of 55 after a successful and happy business career. Then he fell victim to a belief, which practically every alcoholic has, that his long period of sobriety and self-discipline had qualified him to drink as other men. Out came his carpet slippers and a bottle. In 2 months, he was in a hospital, puzzled and humiliated. He tried to regulate his drinking for a while, making several trips to the hospital meantime. Then, gathering all his forces, he attempted to stop altogether, but found he could not. Every means of solving his problem, which money could buy, was at his disposal. Every attempt failed. Though a robust man at retirement, he went to pieces quickly and was dead within 4 years. Right? And then he says, this case contains a powerful lesson. Most of us have believed that if we remain sober for a long stretch, we could thereafter drink normally. But here's a man who at 55 years found he was just where he had left off at 30. We've seen the truth demonstrated again and again. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Commencing to drink after a period of sobriety, we are in a short time as bad as ever. Now, it's important for me to address that, because there's certain things that were changed in the book as the result of that particular statement. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, in my opinion, refers to when you are in your alcoholism, when you are actively drinking. Because in order to be an alcoholic, you have to be currently drinking, according to them. Okay? So if I'm not in my active drinking, I'm not alcoholic. And that's pretty much why I talk about being a recovered alcoholic. Because I was an alcoholic a long time ago, in a galaxy right here, and very bad. I was a bad alcoholic. Okay, but I've been relieved of that. That problem no longer exists for me. And it's as the result of doing this stuff. Okay, so for me, it's really important to talk about that, because as the result of that, it, you know, a few times throughout the book, it changed ex-alcoholics to ex-problem drinkers, you know, to kind of coincide with that particular notion. Now, to me, I think that's kind of unfair, because it forces me to stay sick. It forces me to stay a victim to my alcoholism. And I'm not a victim to my alcoholism, not for a long time. As long as I continue to do the spiritual maintenance on a daily basis and continue to not put alcohol in my body, I will not die of alcoholism. I promise you that. I mean, that's the reality of it. I can't die from alcoholism unless I'm an alcoholic. So, to me, it's kind of unfair. So, I think perhaps a better way of approaching it is that once you're an alcoholic while drinking, you're still going to be an alcoholic while drinking. I think for me, that's what made sense the most to me, and has since then, because that's been proven. That's been proven over and over and over again. I mean, I've seen people, there was a long time, I mean, how many years did he have when he just passed, what, 50-something years?
Almost.
Right. Yeah. Like, I was around when Bill D. celebrated, I got to see him celebrate 50 years. Okay, so to me, 50, he recovered for a long time. And what was funny was he actually said, when they were giving him his piece, he says, I'm finally not in early recovery anymore. I thought that was funny. So it's going to take me 50 years to get out of early recovery. So, okay, so commencing to drink after a period of sobriety, we are a short time as bad as ever. And to me, that's because it kicks off that chemical reaction in the brain. Now, here's part two of step one, right here. If we are planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservation of any kind, nor any lurking notion that someday we will be immune to alcohol. Okay, that's a question that has to be posed to the reader, certainly to myself. A reservation. Is there something that's going to come up in the future that's going to cause me to drink? A lurking notion. That's really cool. A notion is a small thought. Mm-hmm. And lurking means that you're hiding in darkness. So a small thought, hiding in darkness, in the back of my head somewhere. Like, I always give ridiculous examples. I say, like, I won't drink unless it's the third Thursday in October in an odd year. There's a waning moon, and I'm wearing a wizard's hat. Right? Well, you better believe that there's going to be an odd year that I'm in the third Thursday in October with a waning moon with a wizard's hat with a drink in my hand. And then I'd have to drink because that was the condition I created for myself. That was the reservation. And in my experience, anybody who's ever relapsed, I've always asked them, well, what's the reservation? Why did you relapse? Okay? And most of the time you hear the pat cultish answer, I stopped going to meetings. And that's never the answer. It's never the answer. Sorry. That's controversial. I don't care. Decommit me now if you like. But it's never the answer. Because if I'm willing to go to any lengths to not drink, willing, cheerful choice, eagerly compliant to go to any lengths, to do whatever it takes to stay away from that first drink, it means I'm going to get rid of all of those reservations that will be set up in order to cause me to drink. That lurking notion that one day my body will be immune to it will no longer be there. I'll work on getting rid of those things. Okay? I have no reservations about drink. Like, you know, I was married. I didn't drink. I got divorced. I didn't drink then. That was more of a celebratory thing. I certainly wanted to drink, you know? I've seen people lose spouses. I've seen people lose children. I've seen people lose jobs, houses, everything. And because they had this program and they worked the process of this program in their life, they didn't have to drink. It wasn't reason enough for them. Okay, so that's important. You know, and when qualifying somebody for this process, if they want what we have, it's really important for me to ask that question. Do you have any reservations? And I usually get, well, what do you mean? And then I go through my dissertation about it. Okay, so that's really important because if there's a reservation, I could spend... I knew a guy personally. He was a big book guy, too, and it just amazed me. At 28 years of sobriety, he relapsed on solid alcohol, as we'll call it, because he forgot what was told, okay, that we can't safely use alcohol in any form, right? So I asked him, I said, well, what was the reservation? And of course, well, I don't know, I don't think I had one. I was like, well, you had to have one after 28 years of sobriety to jump into that, wouldn't you? So through a little more conversation, he says, well, you know, I hurt my back like 30 years ago. And I said, if the pain gets bad enough, I'll take something. A 30-year reservation. That's amazing. A 30-year reservation. So for me, it always becomes part of my prayer and meditation on a daily basis to try to get to what God wants for me, God's will for me, is to make sure that I'm asking, do I have any reservations? Is there anything that's going to trip me up that I'm going to trip myself up? Okay, and I think that's what people mean when they celebrate and they say, I haven't found it necessary to pick up a drink or a mood or mind-altering substance. Okay, so that's really important, and I think that gets glazed over a lot. Okay, young people may be encouraged by this man's experience to think that they can stop, as he did, on their own willpower. We doubt if many of them can do it, because none will really want to stop, and hardly one of them, because of the peculiar mental twist already acquired, will find he can win out. Several of our crowd, men of 30 or less, had been drinking only a few years, but they found themselves as helpless as those who had been drinking 20 years. That was certainly me. Right? To be gravely affected, now he's going to propose about alcoholism, he's describing it. To be gravely affected, one does not necessarily have to drink a long time, nor take the quantity some of us have. This is particularly true of women. Potential female alcoholics often turn into the real thing and are gone beyond recall in a few years. Certain drinkers, you know, alcoholics of the hopeless variety, who would be greatly insulted if called alcoholics, are astonished at their inability to stop. We who are familiar with the symptoms, obsessive mind, compulsive behavior, phenomenon of craving, manifestation of allergy, see large numbers of potential alcoholics among our young people everywhere, but try to get them to see it. Now, the footnote here has in mind, it says, true when this book was first published, but in 1986, U.S.-Canada membership survey, about one-fifth of AAs were 30 and under. And now, I know that fluctuates depending on the printing of your book. At one point, I saw it get down to one-tenth. Now, just to give a roughly world membership of AA is 2 million. So about one-fifth of that is 30 or under, so they say. Okay, as we look back, we feel we had gone on drinking many years beyond the point where we could quit on our own willpower. Once again, there's that imaginary line, right? If anyone questions whether he has entered his dangerous area, now check this out, let him try leaving liquor alone for 1 year. 1 year, right? If he is a real alcoholic and very far advanced, there's scant chance of success. In the early days of our drinking, we occasionally remain sober for a year or more. What? Alcoholics staying sober for a year or more in the early days of our drinking? That's alien to me. But apparently, in Alcoholics Anonymous, there are people who are alcoholics who usually use that argument of, I didn't drink for like a year and a half. I didn't go to AA. I didn't meet God. It's like, okay, but you've been to 5 detoxes in the past 2 months. So welcome. You know, and it just becomes this, okay, well, if you want to continue to hold on to that argument, just keep arguing with the mirror, and that's that delusion again, right? Okay. In the early days of our drinking, we occasionally remain sober for a year or more, becoming serious drinkers again later. Though you may be able to stop for a considerable period, you may yet be a potential alcoholic. Now, here's a big disclaimer. We think few to whom this book will appeal can stay dry anything like a year. Some will be drunk the day after making their resolutions, most of them within a few weeks. Now, this book, the people that it appeals to, certainly someone like myself. I'm a real alcoholic of the hopeless variety, of an obsessive mind with compulsive behavior. I have a phenomenon of craving, a manifestation of the allergy. I fit this, okay? This appeals to me. This book appeals to me. Usually the people, and this is my experience, that are, you don't need to read the book. All you need to do is don't drink and go to meetings. All you need to do is get a greeting commitment. All you need to do is be the coffee maker. All you need to do is keep coming. Those people, I don't understand them. Maybe they're an alcoholic of a different variety. Okay, but and usually this book doesn't appeal to them. And I think, well, why doesn't it appeal to them? Maybe they can quit on their own willpower. Because if people who are still, who claim to be alcoholics and fit that category, can just not drink, well, maybe they haven't placed themselves beyond human aid yet. And that's who this book appeals to. People who haven't placed them, who have placed themselves beyond human aid. Okay, so there's this big mesh that has gone up, and it scares me, because what about the real alcoholic who needs the message that's carried in this book? Okay, so for every one of me, there's 15 telling somebody new, he's nuts and he's a big book thumper and don't listen to him. And they're steering people away from the solution to their problem. So it's scary. So I put that out there. So if you have this solution and you hear that going on, I challenge you to be like me. You know, instead of lead, follower, get out of the way, obstruct. Obstruct that dangerous course. Because I believe that everybody who has the option and has the ability to get this solution, 100% of the time it can work. That's my opinion. 100% of the time, if they thoroughly follow this path. Okay, so if a different path is given to them, and they follow this one, well, I went to AA. Well, did you do the steps? No. Well, then what were you doing? I sponsored 10 guys. Well, did you do the steps? No. Well, what are you sponsoring them through? What, are you just telling them what to do with their life? I mean, like, I don't understand that. Like, I just don't get it. And to me, it's, you heard what I have to say about it. I'll probably say it again, I'm sure. But, okay. So then it says, for those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. Okay, another disclaimer. We are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. So once again, we're not trying to convince anybody to stop. If you want to stop, here's an answer. If you don't want to stop, nearest bar room, try it more than once, go be done, come on back. There it is. I can wait. Whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. That's what I just talked about. Many of us felt that we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever. Yet, we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it. This utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. Now, I know there are people who have had experience with people like this in AA. The people who are always coming back, they have 2 days. They have 3 days. They have 7 days that they're constantly relapsing. And you just shake your head and you're like, oh, why can't they get it? You know, that baffling feature of alcoholism. And they want to stop, and they're sincere. But they place themselves beyond human aid. And yet we're telling them, just don't drink. Impossible. It says it right there, impossible. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever, yet we found it impossible. And then we're telling people to do the impossible thing? I don't get that. Right? So the utter inability to leave it alone. And then, okay, well, now what? Well, how then shall we help our readers determine to their own satisfaction whether they are one of us? The experiment of quitting for a period of time will be helpful, but we think we could render an even greater service to the alcoholic sufferers and perhaps to the medical fraternity. So we shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking, for obviously this is the crux of the problem. Okay, so crux is the bottom of the V. It's that turning point that I was talking about. Now, it doesn't say we'll describe some of the behavior that precedes a relapse. It doesn't say some of the talking. It says some of the mental states. Mental states. My obsessive mind. Where is it before I'm going to be compelled to pick up that drink? And that's what we're going to describe here. It says, what sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree, which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy, are mystified when he walks directly into a saloon. Why does he? Of what is he thinking? Right? Our first example is a friend we shall call Jim. Now, there's been two people that this has been attributed to. One of them is a gentleman by the name of Ralph F. Some people say that this was his story, although some of the research, like, he never owned an automobile industry or an automobile dealer. So it kind of makes that a bit askew. And the other one is Harlan S., because he did own one and went back to work at the same place. So they kind of that's what the history talks about. So, and both of their stories are in this book here, Experience, Strength, and Hope. And Experience, Strength, and Hope is our book of stories that have been removed from the first, second, and third editions. And it's a wonderful, because it's a snapshot of history throughout AA history. I highly suggest that to anybody who does not own a copy. This man has a charming wife and family. He inherited a lucrative automobile agency. He had a commendable World War record. He is a good salesman. Everybody likes him. He's an intelligent man, normal so far as we can see, except for a nervous disposition. He did no drinking until he was 35. In a few years, he became so violent when intoxicated that he had to be committed. On leaving the asylum, he came into contact with us. We told him what we knew of alcoholism and the answer we had found, that it's an obsession of the mind, compulsion of the body, phenomenon of craving. It's a manifestation of an allergy. We have a spiritual solution. Right? He made a beginning, which means he probably quit drinking. His family was reassembled, and he began to work as a salesman for the business he had lost through drinking. Now, here's the warning. All went well for a time, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. Now, if we remember in Bill's story, he talked about that. He talked about it on 14 and 15. He said, if an alcoholic fails to perfect his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he will not survive the certain low spots and trials ahead. So here's Harlan with a certain low spot and trial right in front of him. And here's what happened, because he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. To his consternation, he found himself drunk half a dozen times in rapid succession. On each of these occasions, we worked with him, reviewing carefully what had happened. He agreed he was a real alcoholic and in serious condition. He knew he faced another trip to the asylum if he kept on. Moreover, he would lose his family, for whom he had a deep affection. Yet he got drunk again. We asked him to tell us how it happened. This is his story. I came to work on Tuesday morning. I always wondered what happened on Monday. I remember I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman for a concern I once owned. And then I decided to drive into the country and see one of my prospects for a car. On the way, I felt hungry. So I stopped at a roadside place where they have a bar. I had no intention of drinking. I just thought I would get a sandwich. I also had the notion that I might find a customer for a car at this place. which was familiar, for I had been going to it for years. I had eaten there many times during the months I was sober. I sat down at a table and ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk. Still no thought of drinking. I ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk. Now, to me, that's just baffling right there. I mean, what was the sandwich? A little cucumber square? I mean, like, eat a sandwich and you're still not full, you have to get another one? Oh, my God. He must have been a big guy. I don't know. Or he hadn't eaten in a while. You know. Right. And then here we go, italics again. Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. I ordered a whiskey and poured it into the milk. I vaguely sensed it was not I was not being any too smart, but felt reassured as I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach. The experiment went so well that I ordered another whiskey and poured it into more milk. That didn't seem to bother me, so I tried another. Wow, insanity. Let me try to do the same thing again, expect a different result. Now, it's really important. That full stomach thing is an old wives' tale. Because liquid goes around the stuff that's in your stomach. It doesn't get absorbed into the food. It gets absorbed 10% in your cheeks, 10% in your esophagus before it even hits your stomach. So 20% of the alcohol is gone before it even hits your stomach. So the other 80% goes into the lining of your stomach and goes into the lining of your intestines and follows on through and goes into your blood and into your liver and up to your brain. And food has nothing to do with it. It never has. That's all our mind telling us. Like coffee never had anything to do with sobering a drunk up. Okay, so just that, you know, it becomes like, oh, a little knowledge. Little knowledge is dangerous, and it certainly wasn't his case. Right? That thus started one more journey to the asylum for Jim. Here was the threat of commitment, the loss of family and position, to say nothing of that intense mental and physical suffering which drinking always caused him. And here's that warning again, right? He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic. Yet all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if only he mixed it with milk. Now, there it is again, right? I've heard it said many times, I know I'm an alcoholic. As long as I know I'm an alcoholic, I won't drink because I know I'm an alcoholic. Well, it says he had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic. So knowing that I'm an alcoholic doesn't really help me. You know, I know I'm Irish too, but that's, you know, right? You know, I know I'm 5'8", but that's not going to make me taller. Right? It's just that logic. Well, I know I'm an alcoholic because I've heard that. I hear people like their big book sits on their nightstand. Right. So when I wake up in the morning, I see that book and I know I'm an alcoholic. Well, how about opening it? You know? Or it's a nice size, like, you know, two-glass coaster, you know what I mean? So just knowing that I'm an alcoholic isn't enough. Because I knew it before I got here. Knew it. Full and through, right? Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? You may think this is an extreme case. To us, it is not far-fetched, for this kind of thinking has been characteristic of every single one of us. We have sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences, you know, thinking the drink through, right? But there were always the curious mental phenomenon that parallel with our sound reasoning, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. Right, so we have this, like, sane brain that's running here on this track. Right, and then we have this insane brain running next to it. And it's kind of going, come on over here. Come on, it's better over here. You know, this one is real hard on the sober one. Oh, my God, look at that. Looks easy over there. And he's going faster. All right, I'm going to go that way. And then it just becomes, what am I doing? Oh, the train's out of control again. And here we go. And, you know, that's what goes on. So, and then it says, our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. The insane idea won out. Next day, we would ask ourselves, in all earnestness and sincerity, how it could have happened. How it could have happened. How indeed. Especially since we know we're an alcoholic. I know I'm an alcoholic. I know it. How did I have a drink? Well, I have this obsessive mind that tells me I need to have a drink. That I can't wait to get to a drink. Makes me work harder to get to a drink quicker. Because if I do my work really well, I deserve a drink. You know, you ever notice that? Like, alcoholics are really good workers when they have to be. Because they can't wait to not work so they can drink the way they want to. Right? I know that was definitely for me. Okay. In some circumstances, we have gone out deliberately to get drunk, feeling ourselves justified. And here's some things we're justified by. Nervousness, anger, worry, depression, jealousy, or the like. But even in this type of beginning, we are obliged to admit that our justification for a spree was insanely insufficient in the light of what has always happened. We now see that when we begin to drink deliberately, instead of casually, there is little serious or effective thought during the period of premeditation of what the terrific consequences might be. Now, this type of thinking. Did you call your sponsor? No, he would have stopped me from drinking. I mean, I've heard that a million times. You're supposed to call before you drink. Well, why would I do that? I wanted a drink. I don't want you to convince me otherwise, and I certainly don't want you giving me guilt while I'm out drinking. Okay, so that's the proper thing, right? Now, it goes on to describe a little more craziness. Our behavior is as absurd and incomprehensible with respect to the first drink as that of the individual with a passion, say, for jaywalking. He gets a thrill of skipping in front of fast-moving vehicles. He enjoys himself for a few years in spite of friendly warnings. Up to this point, you would label him as a foolish chap having queer ideas of fun. Luck then deserts him, and he is slightly injured several times in succession. You would expect him, if he were normal, to cut it out. Presently, he is hit again, and this time has a fractured skull. Within a week after leaving the hospital, a fast-moving trolley car breaks his arm. He tells you that he has decided to stop jaywalking for good. But in a few weeks, he breaks both legs. On through the years, this conduct continues, accompanied by his continual promises to be careful or to keep off the streets altogether. Because that's really the answer, you know. We just learn to fly instead of, like, not jaywalk anymore. Finally, he can no longer work. Thank you. Finally, he can no longer work. His wife gets a divorce, and he is held up to ridicule. He tries every known means to get the jaywalking idea out of his head. He shuts himself up in an asylum, hoping to mend his ways. You know, you hear those people, I have to go to long-term rehab. Why, you need a vacation? I mean, you know, and here's usually what happens to those people who go to those long-term rehabs. But the day he comes out, he races in front of the fire exit, which breaks his back. Such a man would be crazy, wouldn't he? I mean, I heard people that go to prison, they do that all the time. They stay sober in prison, which is because you can get good stuff in prison, from what I hear. And 6 years later, they come out, and the first thing they do is run right to the bar and get hammered. And that's amazing, right? Oh, so it's behavior? No, it's obviously not behavior. It's obviously not self-knowledge. It's an obsessive mind that compels people to do what it is that we do. And we need a solution to that. And it has to be one greater than ourselves, right? So, and then he says again, you may think our illustration is too ridiculous, but is it? We who have been through the ringer, who have to admit, if we substituted alcoholism for jaywalking, the illustration would fit us exactly. However intelligent we may have been for other respects, where alcohol is involved, we have been strangely insane. It's strong language, but isn't it true? Now, it's important for me to point out that writing that we're specifically talking about alcoholism. Okay, we're not saying that people who are alcoholics do everything alcoholically. Because I've heard that for years. I do everything alcoholically. I'm like, well, how is that possible? Is there alcohol in everything you do? I don't get it, you know. So they're trying to, like, victimize themselves that I have this disease that does everything and I have no solution for it. When I screw up, it's the disease. BS, you know. So, some of you are thinking, yes, what you tell us is true, but it doesn't fully apply. We admit we have some of the symptoms, but we have not gone to the extremes you fellows did, nor are we likely to, for we understand ourselves so well after what you have told us that such things cannot happen again. We have not lost everything in life through drinking, and we certainly do not intend to. Thanks for the information. Now, that may be true of certain non-alcoholic people who, though drinking foolishly and heavily at the present time, are able to stop or moderate. Oh, look what they're about to say. Because their brains and bodies have not been damaged as ours were. But the alcoholic, or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. This is a point we wish to emphasize and re-emphasize, to smash home upon our alcoholic readers as it has been revealed to us out of bitter experience. Let's take another illustration. Now, to me, I think the word there, alcoholic, should be changed to all our readers. Because I think everybody who wants to know about alcoholism and AA's opinion about alcoholism and how we have solved our problem, they should read this. And that right there, smashing home, because there's still, in the 21st century, a notion about alcoholics that we're just bums, that we just don't know how to handle ourselves. We just can't control ourselves. Everything, we're just a mess all the time. That there isn't something wrong physically with us, that there isn't something wrong mentally with us, that there isn't some sort of neuropathy, some sort of physiological thing going on in our brain. We're just jerks. Okay? And that's still the stigma. And we're almost in the 12th year of the 21st century, and that's still the stigma. Okay? So, you know, for me, it's important to preach or whatever this is, you know, shouting from the hilltops, because, you know, I'm a recovered alcoholic. That doesn't mean that everything I do is going to be insane. It just doesn't. You know, I don't eat insanely. There are people who do. I don't gamble insanely. There are people who do. There's all those things. Those, you know, the replacement, if you will. The replacement behaviors. Okay, but what I do, I'll tell you this straight up, and I'm glad it'll be on tape too. Okay, what I obsess about now is God. I obsess about God. And it compels me to do these other things, like pray and meditate and go help other people and try to get out of myself, those two things. So it's really cool that the transformation, as the result of these steps, that's what this is about. It gave me a power by which I can solve all my problems. Okay, so even if I'm stuck somewhere else in my life, if I pause and I ask God for an intuitive thought or action, the right answer usually comes. If I'm willing to wait, it's not in my time. It's never been in my time, ever. Even stopping drinking wasn't in my time. I at least had another good 20 years in me. I love that. I had another 20 good years of drinking in me. Probably not. I would have been dead. Okay, so that's what I've replaced my obsessive compulsive nature with, this my higher power. Nobody else's. You can't have mine. Get your own. Okay. Fred is a partner in a well-known accounting firm. This is Harry B. is the name of this person. He was the second chair of the Works Foundation, Alcoholic Foundation, Works Publishing. It's one of the two. Real, it goes way back, obviously. And he was a CPA. His income is good. He has a fine home, is happily married, and the father of promising children of college age. He has so attractive a personality that he makes friends with everyone. If ever there was a successful businessman, it is Fred. To all appearance, he is a stable, well-balanced individual. Yet, he is an alcoholic. We saw Fred about a year ago in a hospital where he had gone to recover from a bad case of jitters. It was his first experience of this kind, and he was much ashamed of it. Far from admitting he was an alcoholic, he told himself that he came to the hospital to rest his nerves. The doctor intimated strongly that he might be worse than he realized. For a few days, he was depressed about his condition. He made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. It never occurred to him that perhaps he could not do so, in spite of his character and standing. Fred would not believe himself an alcoholic, much less accept, what's this? A spiritual remedy for his problem. Not a behavioral modification, a spiritual remedy. Right? We told him what we know about alcoholism, that it's an obsession of the mind, a compulsion of the body, an allergy, and a manifestation of an allergy and a phenomenon of craving. He was interested and conceded that he had some of the symptoms. But he was long way away from admitting he could do nothing about it himself. He was positive that this humiliating experience, plus knowledge he had acquired, would keep him sober for the rest of his life. Self-knowledge would fix it. We heard no more of Fred for a while. One day we were told that he was back in the hospital. This time he was quite shaky. He soon indicated he was anxious to see us. The story he told is most instructive. For he was a chap absolutely convinced he had to stop drinking, who had no excuse for drinking, who explained splendid judgment and determination in all his other concerns, yet was flat on his back nevertheless. Let him tell you about it. I was much impressed with what you fellows said about alcoholism, and I frankly did not believe it would be possible for me to drink again. I rather appreciated your ideas about the subtle insanity which precedes the first drink, but I was confident it could not happen to me after what I had learned. I reasoned I was not so far advanced as most of you fellows, that I had been usually successful in licking my other personal problems, and that I would therefore be successful where you men failed. I had felt I had every right to be self-confident, that it would be only a matter of exercising my willpower and keeping on guard. In this frame of mind, I went about my business, and for a time all was well. I had no trouble refusing drinks, and began to wonder if I had not been making too hard work of a simple matter. Sounds like a reservation to me. Mm-hmm. One day, I went to Washington to present some accounting evidence to a government bureau. I had been out of town before during this particular dry spell, so there was nothing new about that. Physically, I felt fine. Neither did I have any pressing problems or worries. My business came off well. I was pleased and knew my partners would be too. It was the end of a perfect day. Not a cloud on the horizon. I went to my hotel and leisurely dressed for dinner. Italics. As I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to mind that it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner. That was all. Nothing more. I ordered a cocktail and my meal. Then I ordered another cocktail. After dinner, I decided to take a walk. When I returned to the hotel, it struck me. A highball would be fine before going to bed, so I stepped into the bar and had one. I remember having several more that night and plenty next morning. I have a shadowy recollection of being in an airport bound for New York and of finding a friendly taxi cab driver at the landing field instead of my wife. The driver escorted me about for several days. I know little of where I went or what I said and did. Then came the hospital with unbearable mental and physical suffering. As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went over that evening in Washington. Italics again. Not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time, I had not thought of the consequences at all. I had commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. I now remembered what my alcoholic friends had told me, how they prophesied that if I had an alcoholic mind, you know, chemicals in the brain, the time and place would come. I would drink again. They had said that, though I did raise a defense, it would one day give way before some trivial reason for having a drink. Well, just that did happen and more. For what I had learned of alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew from that moment I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. So what he's saying is that he can't think the drink through. I had never been able to understand people who said that a problem had them hopelessly defeated. I knew then it was a crushing blow. Now, I love this next section. Two of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous came to see me. They grinned, which I did not like so much, and then asked me if I thought myself an alcoholic and if I were really licked this time. I had to concede both propositions. They piled on me heaps of evidence to the effect that an alcoholic mentality, such as I had exhibited in Washington, was a hopeless condition. They cited cases out of their own experience by the dozen. This process snuffed out the last flicker of conviction that I could do the job myself. Okay, now they're going to like really hook them. Then they outlined the spiritual answer and a program of action, which 100 of them had followed successfully. Though I had been a nominal churchman, their proposals were not intellectually hard to swallow. Right, check this out. But the program of action, though entirely sensible, was pretty drastic. It meant I would have to throw several lifelong conceptions out of the window. That was not easy. But the moment I had made up my mind to go through with the process, I had the curious feeling that my alcoholic condition was relieved, as in fact it proved to be. Quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems. I have since been brought into a way of living infinitely more satisfying and, I hope, more useful than the life I lived before. My old manner of living was by no means a bad one, but I would not exchange its best moments for the worst I have now. I would not go back to it even if I could. Now, that's where I think that that misconstruing of my worst day sober is better than my best day drunk. And that doesn't say that. Frank's story speaks for itself. We hope it strikes home to thousands like him. He had felt only the first nip of the ringer. Most alcoholics have to be pretty badly mangled before they really commence to solve their problems. Many doctors and psychiatrists agree with our conclusions. One of these men, staff member of a world-renowned hospital, recently made this statement to some of us. and that person was Dr. Percy Pollock of Bellevue. What you say about the general hopelessness of the average alcoholic's plight is, in my opinion, correct. As to two of you men, whose story I have heard, there is no doubt in my mind that you were 100% hopeless, apart from divine help. Had you offered yourselves as patients at this hospital, I would not have taken you, if I had been able to avoid it. People like you are too heartbreaking. Though not a religious person, I have a profound respect for the spiritual approach in such cases as yours. For most cases, there is virtually no other solution. And then here's the summation of it all. It says, once more, there's my colon, right? The alcoholic, at certain times, has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. Okay, so that says a meeting's not going to do it. A sponsor's not going to do it. It's got to be a higher power. Okay, and then when he talks about that spiritual answer, right, the outline of spiritual answer and program of action. Several lifelong convictions. Now, I was 21 when I got here, and I didn't think I had lifelong convictions, but I certainly did, because they told me, you're wrong. I said, about what? And they said, everything. I said, I can't be wrong about everything. They're like, you're here, aren't you? I'm like, yeah, but this is AA. This is about my alcoholism. They're like, yeah, but if you read the book, you'll understand that it's about your thinking. And your thinking is what brought you here. Okay, so if your thinking is that screwed up and that insane, and it's bringing you here, even though you know you're an alcoholic, and you can't stop on your own, and you need a higher power, guess what? Your lifelong conviction of like, oh, I can do it on my own. Because that's how I grew up. I grew up with a father who said things like, I'm not powerless over anything. Wow. I hear that now. There's people who are critics of AA. They say that all the time. They freely write articles and post them on the internet. They say, I'm not powerless over anything. And to those people, I say, stop a wave. Step in front of the tsunami. See what kind of power you have then. Catch a lightning rod. You know, a lightning bolt. Something. Watching the sun. Create a sunset. You know, it's just amazing to me. Like, I have to believe that I'm not in charge of the universe. And I don't want to be. Because when I was, it was all screwed up. I was crazy. Crazy. Insane. Doing the same stuff over and over, expecting different results. You know, so I think Bill Wilson and the founders did a wonderful job of really describing the difference between certain types of hard drinkers and moderate drinkers and the alcoholic. You know, and that's basically what I think more about alcoholism is. So with that, I'm done. I hope I helped somebody tonight. Thanks. Q&C section.
The Q&C section is officially over. Comments, queries, concerns, questions, critiques.
Quibbles, quarrels.
Quarrels, especially quarrels. Anything from the floor? Anybody want to take any violent outbursts just for fun? Go.
To the alcoholic at certain times of the
group,
that mental defense against first drink, leading by certain times.
Well, he described that within the chapter, that at certain times, you know, you face something that you've normally faced in your life, and we'll see in the next chapter especially that the only power that you have is to take a drink. Okay, so you come up against something, and it's generally, especially people who are new in recovery, within that first year, how are they going to do this without a drink? And then you face with that problem, and now you have no idea, you're blank. You have no way of like, oh, no, I don't need that drink, or no, I need to call somebody, or I need to get out of here. There's that mental blank spot. That it's like there was a movie playing, and they just kind of clicked out that part that showed you getting drunk and being arrested or whatever it was there. So that's that peculiar mental blank spot, that twist.